Welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm your host, Rajni Gamage, a postdoctoral fellow at the Institute. Sri Lanka's foreign relations are influenced significantly by attempts to recover from the national economic crisis in 2022. The country's inflation has fallen to single digits after 2 years, one of the world's highest a year ago. In March 2023, Sri Lanka secured a US $2.9 billion International Monetary Fund Extended Fund Facility arrangement. However, its economic situation remains precarious, with the foreign reserve of US $3.6 billion reported in August this year, and with foreign debt restructuring still in progress. To understand Sri Lanka's foreign relations against national, regional, and international developments, I'm joined by former Ambassador Mr. ALA Aziz, former Permanent Representative of Sri Lanka to the United Nations in Geneva and Vienna. Thank you for joining me today, Mr. Aziz.
Thank you, and I'm very happy that I'm on this program. Thank you for inviting me.
Yes. So to get the conversation started, let me ask you the question on what your opinion is on Sri Lanka's current trajectory of foreign relations. Do you detect some distinct principles that guide Sri Lanka's current foreign policy, and what may some of these be?
No, well, the issue is, the question is the difference between past and present. And of course, you know, the history was so fluid, you know, so therefore, I think there are several past and several present. But of course, let us take the period preceding July 22 as past. This is the people struggle period or Aragalaya period. And the present, of course, after July 2022 till today. So we may call it post-Aragalaya period, but many people may not like, calling it so. Aragalaya, of course, emerged as a result of economic crisis, so which led to a humanitarian crisis. But of course, what caused this crisis? Bad decision making, wrong policies, and mismanagement of economy, as we all know, right? Importantly, also, Rajni, there was an isolation of the country in the international arena with limited external interactions. It grew slowly, but then, of course, you know, it happened really, right? We may call it international isolation for the sake of discussion, but it is more of a case of the country isolating itself. In my view, it is a political and diplomatic failure in addition to economic failure. So therefore, in short, before the economic bankruptcy started, now there was a foreign policy bankruptcy or foreign relations bankruptcy, I should say. So then, but of course, COVID-19 and COVID-related politics increased the isolation. Of course, that divided communities also. And to explain the situation, people were liberally using all kinds of concepts. Some of the concepts that were deployed as a way of face saving, neutrality, non-alignment, leveraging, hedging, balancing, bandwagoning. These were all impressed on the people, and also others, that the government is doing the right thing, but it drew a blank. So, as we could see, much of it did not have any content or substance, rather rhetoric. Now, coming to the present, Rajni, new president and a new dispensation have come to power in July last year. And their immediate challenges, of course, was to have the immediate humanitarian needs attended to, while, of course, trying to restore law and order as well. So, anyway, there was a legitimacy overhang, how to win public confidence, to reach out to the world for help at the same time. That remained as the major challenge. Of course, you know, nobody was talking, especially the political leadership was not talking about it openly, but that was the underlying fact. So, if international isolation was partly responsible for the crisis that followed, at the beginning of 2022, I'm not belittling, by saying the other important factors, by saying that international isolation. Breaking out of that isolation was felt necessary after July 2022, to reach out to the world for immediate humanitarian other needs and other needs. So the impulse was such that impulse was that such international outreach would effectively whittle away legitimacy challenge as well. So in the meantime, there was a concern entertained by a section of the international community, which included India too. In particular, India, Sri Lanka cannot be a failed state, and that all possible assistance should be given to Sri Lanka to prevent such a scenario. So this, of course, is the context. So the Sri Lanka's foreign relations trajectory today, in my view, should be be assessed or seen against this particular backdrop. So it manifests in two different ways. The first point is Sri Lanka's international interactions have increased out of necessity. So the principle of necessity apply here on the part of the government, and as well as due to realization by other external actors that they should also assist Sri Lanka in this hour of despair. Negotiations continued with international financial institutions adding some weight to this approach. The second point that I would like to make, Rajini, is while international interactions have increased, how much they are transforming themselves into improved relations on a wider scale that is needed to lift Sri Lanka out of the morass it has fallen into, of course, remains to be seen. I think the coming day, and also especially in the lead up to any general elections in Sri Lanka, would reveal that one, in my view. So what is clearly seen is there is much less emphasis on certain concepts which were over-relied on or used as rhetoric by the previous government, which form part of the foreign policy of Sri Lanka before July 2022. However, we also observe that in some sections of the government, the propensity of resorting to some such concepts and principles is still prevail. And also, unfortunately, as a German philosopher once said, I should recall this one because he said that the past is still present in some areas of governance, because I feel there are continuing temptation there for using some of the anti-democratic and rights restriction measures like in the past. So overall, there are international interactions which have expanded, and some relations have been strengthened. Sri Lanka is a little more open than it used to be, and but then so many other principles, they have not been discarded, but they are not being actively used, in my view. So these are the distinct principles now seems to be a necessity, and like-minded means cooperation. And working, working with partners in a more friendly way,
Yes.
manifesting no enmity. That seems to be the principles now which are at play.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Aziz. So I thought it was very interesting because you took us some key ideas there, starting from the fact that prior to Sri Lanka declaring economic bankruptcy, that it was
Right.
actually facing a condition of foreign policy bankruptcy, and
Absolutely.
also highlighting the audience to the fact that Sri Lanka's current engagement with its international partners is largely driven by necessity of trying to manage the situation out of the economic crisis as we face it. And I think you also raised a few other very interesting points there. I'll just first start off the follow-up question on that, which is that you mentioned that the current government, out of necessity, has been more open and engaging with international partners. So what would you identify as Sri Lanka's approach towards multilateralism and regional engagement? I'm saying this as we observe the current government being more active in forums such as the Indian Ocean Rim Association. We also saw the president recently, and in other instances, making strong statements on climate change at beyond the national level. So I was keen to we were keen to find out what Sri Lanka's approach towards multilateralism and regional engagement are, and what potential avenues Do you
Right.
observe Sri Lanka following to assume a more active player, to assume a more active role in the region and even global order?
No, well, I think Sri Lanka has a serious capacity constraint, in my view, when it comes to negotiating skills and diplomatic skills. We have got fine diplomats, but however, over a period of time, I think their standards have fallen. So therefore, it's a kind of a responsibility the government of Sri Lanka and the international community also invest in Sri Lanka's diplomacy to get the best return of diplomacy to the world and the region at large. So it's a kind of a very controversial observation, but it has to be made, right? But as far as Sri Lanka's multilateralism and regional engagement is concerned, of course, there has always been in Sri Lanka's foreign policy and foreign relations a streak of multilateralism. Always been there has always been there. So it has been there since Sri Lanka became a member of the UN, and even before, or even simultaneously, starting with the Bandung Conference and Commonwealth membership, and also later SAARC, IORA, BIMSTEC, and many others, really, right? So what is happening now? What is happening before that? And multilateralism has remained an important feature of Sri Lanka's foreign policy, which I said. But however, it is a mix of regional and international forms of multilateralism. So we play a very active role. We used to play a very active role in regional organizations like SAARC and BIMSTEC at once. And simultaneously, we also played in certain areas of multilateral engagement, particularly peacekeeping, law of the sea, internet security, and then development, especially international security. We were leading in the counterterrorism discourses, really, right? So Sri Lanka has manifested its commitment to and participated at the same time, giving leadership as well. Not necessarily just multilateral processes, but also the outcomes and mechanisms. So staying in, participating rather than contributing, contributing for a formality's sake. I think staying in, participating, outcome follow-up, everything has been Sri Lanka's tested and proven foreign policy traits in the past. I think I'm talking about past, not 2019, 2020, 21, or even 22, right? It's before, long before. Particularly, the period, immediately after we became non-aligned member of non-aligned movement. And for instance, peace and mediation missions of the UN, I think Sri Lanka has participated. Peacekeeping operation is still. Disarmament, for even now, I think we have seen ratification of two important agreements recently, the total prohibition of nuclear weapons treaty and the comprehensive test ban nuclear test ban treaty, really, right? So much more we have contributed. Now it seems to be actually extending to other forum. That is also because of the realization that we need to reach out and we need to establish constituencies abroad which would be supportive of Sri Lanka. At the same time also, and improving our engagements with those organizations so that mutually beneficial outcomes and relationship can be established there. So and Sri Lanka has always played a critical role in some of the many complex negotiations, and it has helped to build a consensus on apparently intractable issues like law of the sea and disarmament at some point, 1995 NPT review and extension conference chaired by Ambassador Jayantha Dhanapala, assisted by some able foreign service officers and others, actually was a turning point. But the world did not live up to the promise it made, including kind of a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. That, of course, is a failure on the part of major players, I should say. So Sri Lanka has done its job. So Most importantly, within the region, and particularly in the international context, of course, in the development of international law, the role played by Sri Lanka, of course, some of its distinguished nationals, is too significant not to mention here, Rajini. This contribution was not just in ensuring the application of norms, but also in elaborating and interpreting, most importantly, legal provisions. So now what is happening is we have identified, Sri Lanka seems to have identified certain priority areas like, you know, climate change. So at COP28, Sri Lanka has initiated and led some processes, especially with regard to climate change, you know, climate justice and University for Climate Change, etc., right? And carbon trading, all kind of things are actually involved in that particular process, right? At the same time, and Sri Lanka in the remaining 7 years or 4 years, the 5-6 years that are left out of, you know, the UN Development Agenda 2030, and trying to find certain areas where it can be a kind of an example, you know, but it is a challenging task because you have to catch up with what you lost during, you know, the period beginning 2019, really, right? Mm-hmm. Especially after the build-up of the economic crisis. So these are challenges. Currently, Sri Lanka is also chairing IORA Council. A number of new initiatives are under consideration there, as I understand.
Mm-hmm.
And both in its multilateral and bilateral format, economic diplomacy is a key area. And so not just, you know, you just conduct, you know, kind of an engagement with other parties or other actors, but also, you know, it must consist of goal orientation, benchmarking, outreach capacity, like, you know, and also a clear economic vision, professionalism and leadership. So these are things I think, you know, a lot of thoughts are going on, so a lot of discussions are going on. And this is vital for Sri Lanka's future.
Yes.
So basically, the country has also simultaneously started engaging with ASEAN Regional Forum, BAO mm-hmm. Forum, Shanghai Forum, and particularly it has reached out to, you know, the countries which are party to the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership. But it may be a long shot, but it's still worth mm-hmm. taking, right?
So, yes.
Today, external interactions that Sri Lanka pursues, of course, are driven by the compelling need to emerge successfully from the multiple challenges that country faces. You know, this is reality, of course.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Aziz. I think once again, you very comprehensively took us through some of the more nuanced aspects of Sri Lanka's current foreign policy. And I especially wanted to highlight the fact that even as Sri Lanka engages more actively in certain forum, the capacity
yeah.
problem that you mentioned, but then also very importantly, how even as we observe Sri Lanka engaging in certain forms of climate diplomacy, because
right.
as we know, Sri Lanka is a small littoral state, so it shares many of the same threats that other countries, other small island states
yeah.
face as well, such as climate change, food security, and such, as you had highlighted. So the fact that on the one hand, climate diplomacy needs to be wielded, but also because many countries around the world are facing certain forms of debt and economic stress, that
yeah.
economic diplomacy also is being simultaneously wielded.
Absolutely.
So that's a very kind of interesting and developing
yeah.
scenario as we watch it. I wanted to ask the final question, which links to these themes.
Yeah.
And that is how, with the challenges that Sri Lanka faces, but also as we see certain developments at the global level, whether it is in terms of global conflict or whether it
yeah.
is in terms of global economic downturn, and we have these multiple issues coming up simultaneously. The question is, how can Sri Lanka cushion the impact of these more proactively? Because as you mentioned, we also
yeah.
have elections expected in 2024. So even at the national level, we are expecting to see some kind of political activity happening. So how do you foresee these kind of national politics and the global politics intersecting to impact Sri Lanka's foreign policy?
Actually, the thing is that there is a particular concept called in-domestic principle, right? So it is a kind of an international priority or obligation and a domestic compulsion. Sri Lanka has to get the balance right. There is no doubt about it. So I think our approach to international engagement should be really inspired or driven by domestic priorities, but at the same time, we also should understand that the certain international obligations we have taken over should also bear on our own domestic policy. So it's a healthy balance, and then it, of course, it helps you to preserve your foreign policy space while pursuing beneficial projects or proposals with other countries and entities. So it is in that context, I think, we are lacking in a way. I think I hope that, that balance at some point, serious, attention would be given to restoring that balance. Once that balance is restored, and also in the lead up to, the effort, I think, there will be a lot of effects on Sri Lanka's economy, and certain sectors, especially the vulnerable communities, arising from international and regional development. So we have two issues here. One is Ukraine-Russia situation, right? And of course, that came at a wrong time for Sri Lanka, because the strains of a looming balance of payment crisis were being felt in Sri Lanka very intensely. So with an increase in global oil price, and also political and economic chaos in Europe reaching other parts of the world, there were preventive efforts. So this particular thing added to Sri Lanka's then emerging economic crisis. So that point is important to keep in mind. And also European American economic sanctions also impacted some sectors of Sri Lanka's economy, particularly tea industry and tourism industry. And Russia was one of the largest tea markets for Sri Lanka. And Russian and Ukrainian tourists usually prefer visiting Sri Lanka, and they do in significant numbers and in the past. So in the context of Russia Ukraine situation, a particular issue that came up was overstaying by tourists from both countries, particularly Ukraine. And Sri Lanka took a policy decision to allow visa extension, and also some measure of protective and safety measures or safety arrangements were also made. So then the situation was a concern for foreign policy and diplomacy, no doubt, naturally, right? Invariably, it has also, since it became an item, also a concern that influences our discourses with external players. It has since become an item of the agenda for bilateral, multilateral discussion with the US as well as Sri Lanka's European partners. So anyway, Sri Lanka has remained neutral, taking into account a number of factors, including economic interest and also the interest of Sri Lanka, the geopolitical interest, and also the interest of Sri Lanka in the larger world. But however, there was some tendency to be more sensitive to Russia. There is no doubt about it, needs to be recorded. But of course, by and large, when it comes to critical decision making in the policy making bodies of international organizations, I think Sri Lanka has manifested a kind of a neutral stand. Then, while this was going on, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict came, and then, of course, that is something that is happening not too far from the region that we are located. So the first concern is the likely effect of it. If it is not resolved, the resolution is the most important thing, but then we also know that that is a long, intractable, apparently intractable issue. It has been there for over 30, 75 years. So if it is not resolved, it should be managed in a way there is no regional spillover. So, the problem could, of course, add to Sri Lanka's economic woes because regional instability, especially regional instability, may affect sea lanes and movement of commercial and other vessels on the sea. With the possibility, maybe only shudder at the thought, Straits of Hormuz, being a possible choke point. It's a choke point, geopolitically, it's already been identified as a choke point, but used as a choke point, and then and creating the disruption or diversion is a situation that we have to avoid. And on top of it, Sri Lanka's migrant labor in the Middle East. There are, more than 500,000 people, and estimates vary. Their lives and their lives in those countries and their livelihoods are all at stake there. So, and it will also have a severe impact on the energy security since we depend on fuel from Middle East. So, basically, to come to the final point of my presentation or answer on that, Sri Lanka remains among countries, of course, which are engaged with major players on these issues, and it includes USA, EU, and of course, I guess, I hope, or India and China, in ensuring there is no regional escalation. And at the same time, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and also Egypt and Jordan, which all maintain good relations with Sri Lanka. And we also, I hope, dialogues are going on. I'm not sure, but I know that, all these countries have good, bilateral relations with Sri Lanka. So then multi-level engagements, hopefully, with all countries, that have stakes in the situation should continue, and if have not been started, I think, or explored, I think should be initiated immediately.
Thank you, Mr. Aziz. I think that you did a difficult job of trying to kind of summarize some of the very complicated developments that are happening at the global level and some of the constraints and opportunities that Sri Lanka faces in trying to navigate these fast evolving situations at the global level, at the regional level, and especially at the national level. We have a very interesting year coming forward in 2024 with elections slated. So, how that impacts Sri Lanka's foreign relations, hopefully, your insights will give our listeners some scope to better understand these developments as we watch them unfold next year. So, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Rajini. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a good experience for me, and I really value this opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you. So, you were listening to former Ambassador Mr. ALA Aziz, former permanent representative of Sri Lanka to the United Nations in Geneva and Vienna. You are listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, please visit us at isas.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates through social media. We are on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you.